First of all, thanks a lot for the organizers. I remember with great pleasure, 5 years ago, we were doing this 30 years of asymptotic safety conference, and we were all a bit younger, but it's really a pleasure to see most of the people back there. We were advertised that during the time we live in our platonic world of mathematics, physics is going on, but okay, for those who like mathematics, I would like to mention there is this workshop where you can also sort of relax from the stress of physics into this eternal contemplation of mathematics. Okay, so let me see how this works. Okay, so yes, matrices and tensors. Wow, how is it going? You know how we go to the next one? Doesn't work? Okay, let me try with this. Yeah, okay. So, we have, we were told by Tim that we are on an island and we have a treasure to search. And this treasure, we sort of agree in this, at least in this group, that it would be fixed point of a renormalization group for gravity. And they should have a finite number of marginal and relevant directions, preferably, so that physics is predictive. But the question we are maybe differing is how to search and in which theory space will the computation be easiest? You know, there could be only one theory space because after all, there is only one Hilbert space which is countable. But the question is, how do you find a good basis in it? And devil is in the detail there. It could be simpler if we use a good basis. So we could see the tensor track as a kind of candidate for such a theory space, which comes from a combinatoric and discretized point of view. So, well, it is certainly inspired by the success of matrix models, so it is an attempt to generalize matrix model. It is certainly from the start something which is background independent and something which naturally sums over all topologies. In fact, all manifolds can be parametrized via tensor graphs and even a certain class of quasi-manifolds. What I will say is that very easily with the simplest model that you can look at, the quartic models in rank 3 and 4, you already encompass phases like branch polymers and Brownian spheres. And that the field theory version of the tensor track includes both asymptotically safe and asymptotically free understand, fixed points that can be understood analytically. Okay. What is the main idea on which, if it is wrong, then we can forget about the tensor track? Is there one idea which would sort of falsify the whole story? Well, the one idea I would like to put forward is that just like in renormalization group, there is a particular class of interactions which are local and you try to flow around them. Well, it is the idea that we could see locality as a symmetry. If we have no background space, we would have to content ourselves with a space which is algebraic in nature and objects which are combinatorics, for instance. And then the idea is that we would have a many-component field because we want to represent a large universe. And then there would be a notion of locality as a symmetry. So what could it be? Could be related to some kind of invariance on the change of basis for this big vector. So that is the idea which was the guiding thread. So then we would have a space which would be made of local terms. It would be the analog of local monomials, phi of n to the x in a theory which has a background. So the idea is that this space of local terms would be the space of connected invariants, which are polynomial in the components of phi bar phi. And in this way, we could see the difference between vectors or matrices or tensors, because they are all blocks of numbers. The difference would just be a breaking of the symmetry. Then there is another breaking, which would be the breaking of this locality property. For instance, at propagator level, this would define what Trasvant called tensor or tensor group field theory. Group because usually as soon as you want to introduce this breaking, you need to have a kind of, for instance, Laplacian, and on the group there is a nice notion of Laplacian. And then it would define what are the quasi-local observables, like, for instance, the Laplacian or powers of the Laplacian and so on. Okay, then let's go on with the idea, how do you go from vector to tensors through matrices? Well, just by breaking the symmetry. What distinguishes vector models in this setting from matrix models and tensor models is the way you organize the components of your big vector, of your big field. So if you want to consider a vector field, it has n components. And then if you want to impose the full base invariance, for instance, you want to impose that the local terms should be invariant under full basis change. So the full U of n group. So then we know there is only one so-called connected polynomial invariant, which is a scalar product. The only invariants are then the powers of the scalar product. And okay. Suppose now that n is a product. Suppose n is not 17, but 16 or 18. Then it can be decomposed as a product n1 of times n2. And then the difference between matrix models and vector models is just that you restrict the symmetry. Instead of asking for a u n1 n2, that is a u of n symmetry, you just ask for u of n1 times u of n2, which is much smaller. So it's a symmetry breaking. But the reason, as soon as you break the symmetry, you have more invariance, of course. And now the invariance of matrix model, we will see, they are the traces of m dagger to the power p. There are many connected invariants. There's just not a single one. So then the root for matrix to tensor models is just as simple as continuing the idea. If n is not only the product of two numbers, but the product of three numbers, or four numbers, or five numbers, then there is another way of breaking the symmetry, which is instead of imposing the full u of n, try to impose only u of n1, tensor u of n2, tensor u of nd. So you have a still reduced symmetry, still more invariance. So that's just this. So we have all seen now that one can describe this tensor invariance because the rank D invariants were classified for us by mathematicians. And the polynomial connected rank D invariants, they are in one-to-one correspondence with regular D edge-colored connected biparted graphs. And they can be counted, and here is the result. If you have vectors, as I said, there is only one connected invariant, which is a scalar product, and it is phi bar times phi. So the least of connected invariants at order n starts with the one, the scalar product, and nothing more. Okay, for matrices, well, it starts also with the one, and then you have a sequence, a whole sequence of ones, because there is exactly one invariant with two p vertices. It's trace of m dagger to the power p. And the reason is there is only one biparted connected graph, which is one edge colored, but there are an infinite sequence, all the traces, which are two edge colored. And now, if you look at three edge colored graphs, you will find the following sequence 1, 3, 7, 26, 4,000, 1, 6, 3, etc. And for four, you will find even more. Okay? So I want to say that at any rank, there is only one quadratic term which is invariant. So there is only one possibility for a mass term, if you like. It's the scalar product. This one doesn't change. What changes is later, you see. And I have put in red these two because these are what I will call quartic tensor models. These are the terms with p equals 2, so which are quartic in the field. They have the first interaction term that you can put in a tensor model. And they are interesting, and I will return to them. So now you have seen all seen these diagrams. So Razwa explained that these D edge colored graphs, they are not only the invariants, they can also be thought of either as vertices of a theory for the tensor T and T bar, which then will have propagators, which will add still another color to the graph. They can be vertices, but they can also be the observables. They are also the observables of the theory. So they are both the vertices and the observables. And you can have connected ones, or you have products of connected ones, which are disconnected ones. All right. Then the next step is, how do you solve models? Well, there is one thing which is the simplest way perhaps you can solve this sequence of model is when you look at a vector model, there is a very efficient way of solving the model, which is to introduce an intermediate field. So if you have a vector model, the only way you can put an interaction is to put a disconnected invariant, you know, the scalar product to the square, because there is no over one, you know, there is no connected one. So you have to do this. And that's why the theory is a bit trivial. If you write a partition function for an interacting vector model, you have the Gaussian part. I don't put maybe always this normalization. And then I decide to normalize like that the interaction part so that I could get a limit when the size of the vector becomes big. And how do I solve this limit? Well, in that case, it's particularly easy because the 5 by 5 square is a square of the scalar product. I can just sort of disentangle it by introducing a scalar intermediate field sigma. What is this trick? It means that instead of having this term, you write it as the integral over this sigma field of this term. Because, you know, when you compute the square here, you find back this square. But now, the phi bar phi integral becomes Gaussian. You can therefore compute it, and you find an effective interaction for a scalar field, just a one-component field. N has become a parameter, and it's extremely easy to compute the n equals n going to infinity limit through a saddle point computation. So you look at the saddle of this integral, and it is given by a formula like that, where z is the square root of lambda. And it means that you will be able to compute the n going to infinity limit, for instance, of the logarithm of this or of the of the two-point function, for instance. It's slightly easier for the two-point function. The two-point function in the infinite limit is exactly this function, which happens to be the generating function of Catalan numbers. And Catalan numbers exactly count rooted plane trees. And we understand why we find this theory of rooted plane trees. If you have a rooted plane tree, sorry, I should have put a mark on the root here. If you have a rooted plane tree, there is a one-to-one correspondence with one of these sigma field graphs. This is the sigma field propagator, and these are the sort of remnants of the phi bar phi integration that entered in this logarithm. And this is a two-point function mark, because I am looking at a two-point function. So you see that these graphs are in one-to-one correspondence with these ones, so it's not surprising that the n going to infinity limit is given by counting these Catalan numbers. And it's also not surprising that for this reason, the random geometry corresponding to vector models is that of branched polymers, because this thing is also physically what people call a branched polymer. All right. Then next step, we have sort of finished with vector models, because vector models don't go much further than this. If you try to introduce loops now, which corresponds to the finite n correction to this, then there is no way to organize them. Each time I give you a loop, no matter whether it is planar, non-planar, it just gives me a 1 over n vector, and there is no structure there. So there doesn't seem to be any interesting, for instance, double scaling limit for vectors. Okay, so life becomes already much more interesting with matrix models. First of all, then we can really use a genuine connected interaction. We are not forced to just take the square of a disconnected interaction. So we took that the most interesting model in that case, matrix model in that case, would have a trace of M4 interaction. This thing is connected, contrarily to the previous one. And then we know, since Toft explained it, to us that this has a double expansion in powers of lambda and n, which is of topological nature. Namely, the terms are suppressed in 1 over n in proportion to 2 minus 2g, which is this combination, which can also be understood as a genus of the Riemann surface, which is associated to a triangular to a graph here, because you know these graphs of matrix model will be will have Riemann surfaces associated because they are naturally ribbon graphs. Okay, so the expansion is led by planar graphs, and it has more interesting, not only single but double scalings limit when n going to infinity. First of all, the fact that it is possible sort of to solve to go quite far into the theory to solve it maybe is already a precursor of this fact was the fact that just like Catalan was able to count plane trees, Tut was able to count planar quadrangulations. Sorry, there is something wrong here. And this is the number of planar quadrangulation, and it's quite surprising and interesting to see that it bears a relation to the previous theory. That's obvious because we see here the Catalan number of the previous theory, but this Catalan number is now dressed by this very interesting 3 to the n factor, and there is this surprising correction. Okay, if you do the single scaling limit of this theory, you find that the two-point function of matrix model has again a square root singularity, not exactly, three half singularity because we have this additional n. And instead of being at the point, the point is slightly different because this 24 also reflects this three and depends a bit on how I normalize the lambda term and so on. But essentially, you get a similar structure and you can solve an infinity limit. And the random geometry is now different. What is very interesting is that this factor was not innocent. It has dressed this tree with a certain set of planar loops that can be exactly determined. And through the so-called Scheffer map. And the random geometry is different. It is called the Bornean sphere geometry. Okay, if we apply, this is not necessary, but if we try to apply the intermediate field method to that matrix model, it is interesting, and it leads in particular to understand that the n going to infinity limit, in fact, reflects the existence of the finite n theory, which is Borel summable uniformly in n. And I think for the moment, this is the only method I know which can prove this uniform Borel summability in n with sort of the best analyticity domain up to now. So intermediate field method is useful for matrices also, although it doesn't immediately solve the model like in the case of vectors. And there is an interesting double scaling, so I'll say a few words about the double scaling. This has been the subject of much attention in string theory because this was under the search for a non-perturbative formulation, you know, of string theory. So the double scaling, sometimes called 2D pure gravity or string theory moving on a point. It is possible to think to it as a kind of double scaling of a matrix model, but it's better to introduce all the invariant traces. And here I didn't use the name and an M bar by just, for instance, an Hermitian matrix model, but it's related. But what I would like to say is that one can both study this double scaling through invariant models, but also surprisingly by a non-invariant model. This was the breakthrough sort of Koncevich, who solved the conjecture of Witten that this was really expressing some interesting objects called the intersection of moduli spaces for this string can be computed in terms of certain generating functions. So the Koncevich model is a different matrix model, which instead of having many interactions, has just the simplest interaction, the trace of M cube interaction, but it has a non-invariant quadratic part. So you break the the UN invariance of matrix model by this term with this lambda, which has a spectrum. So it is like breaking locality. If you interpret this invariance as locality, it looks much more like a field theory. This is called the interaction is local, and this would be called the propagator. You know, propagator is not exactly local. It has a Laplacian in it. So this is a kind of analog of the Laplacian. And there was, even in that case, a kind of explicit correspondence between what you put, what you should put here in order to make contact with this. So I won't say anything longer about this, just to say that we have been hearing in Tim's talk about the Gross-Vulkenaar model. I would like to stress that the Gross-Vulkenaar model, one of the best way to think to it, is to think to it as a Koncevich-type model with a trace M4 instead of trace M3 interaction and a particular value of the Koncevich rule. Yes, no problem. So let me list again a few of the marvelous properties of the Gross-Vulkenaar model. And they have been extended a bit in recent years because Gross and Vulkenaar continue working on it. So I would like to say that Gross-Vulkenaar model is perturbatively renormalizable. It is asymptotically safe. It has a 4D geometric interpretation, which is a bit curious for a 2D sort of matrix model. Usually are interpreted as 2D. The mechanism which creates the ultraviolet fixed point is well understood analytically. It has to do with the Ward identity of this breaking of the symmetry, plus a kind of Langmann-Szabo symmetry, which between momentum and positions, which I'm sure Laurent likes a lot. And then there is two surprising things which have emerged more recently. If you look at a certain limit called the infrared limit or theta going to infinity limit, the interpretation on 4D becomes very interesting because the model gets restricted to a submodel which has exactly Euclidean 4D invariance. Although initially, the Gross-Vulkenaar model was thought as being defined on the Moyal space, which has not at all SO4 invariance. And finally, even more exciting perhaps, there is numerical evidence that the Gross-Vulkenaar model is unitary in a certain range of parameters, which, if true, and if it could be proven, really this would be the first four-dimensional interacting model that satisfies all Whiteman axioms, which would be quite incredible. Okay. Next is to go from, I have a little time left, 10 minutes now, to go from matrices to tensor, and I think I will be stuck in between because I will show you only tensor models that reduce to matrix models so that I can say something about them. So I will show you what are, so let's start now with the tensor model. And the first question is, what are the simplest ones? Okay. Simplest one, I want the simplest one. So certainly the simplest of all tensor models is at rank 3 with quartic interaction, cannot do simpler. So then how many invariants do you have? Well, you have 3. You have this one, and this one. Okay, let's suppose we want to keep the symmetry, permutation symmetry between color. We put a single interaction coupling constant in front, and then the model can be written like that. Here is the quadratic part, and you have these 3 interactions, and you put a certain scaling in front to have a good limit. And these objects can be seen as trace of squares of the partial traces. So this is the trace, and these are the partial traces. And therefore, because you have these 3 partial traces, you can analyze the model with the intermediate field representation. But the intermediate field representation will require to introduce a matrix intermediate field, no longer a scalar like for vector models. So these things, sigmas, are matrices, but they are n by n matrices. And once you have done this, you can integrate over the tensors because you have made the integral quadratic. And you find a coupled, a representation of the partition function in terms of 3 coupled matrices. So you see the quartic tensor model is just a certain model of 3 matrices coupled in this bizarre way, which apparently was never considered before in matrix theory. Well, and this representation simplifies the expansion. For instance, if you have heard about this infamous Melanie graphs, they just become trees in this representation. And one can understand a Melonic limit as a saddle point limit, like for the vector models. And this builds a bridge between tensor and matrix models and could even have some interesting extension towards some subjects which interest string theory, but I will leave that for eventually for future questions. So my next slide is just to show you how in this representation, graphs which could be relatively complicated to write in the tensor representation simplify into graphs in which these colors reappear now, but they mean now the intermediate matrix propagators. So remember, there was a sigma 1, a sigma 2, a sigma 3. Therefore, I had for these lines an uncolored graph, and here I find again a colored graph, but because I completely exchanged the meaning of the propagators and the vertices. The loops of this field becomes vertices, and these external legs becomes marks like that, and these things become propagators. So you see, it can change a little bit the intuition. This graph becomes this, and so on and so forth. And you see that these graphs are now ribbon graph. Okay, so this is all I wanted to say on this. So this simplifies the model. The use of this intermediate field simplifies the model and allows to visualize better. For instance, visualize the Melonic graph simply as trees. This was the Melonic graph. This is a tree. This was the Melonic graph. This is a tree. This was not Melonic, and these are not trees. Okay. So we have finished for what I wanted to say about the quartic tensor model at rank 3, but then even more interesting is the quartic tensor model at rank 4, because I have now 7 quartic invariants. 4 of them are Melonic of this type, and 3 of them are matrix-like of this type, okay? So I can still apply the method of intermediate field, but I will have small matrices when I cut like that and big matrices when I cut like that, okay? But I can still do it. If I put the standard scaling lambda over n cubed in front of these terms and lambda over n cubed in front of these, the 1 over n tensor expansion will have a Melonic limit. But if I scale differently, if I put a lambda n to the minus cube here and a lambda n to the minus square here, then I will have a competition between the branch polymer or Melonic and the Brownian sphere behavior. And there could be an interesting result. In particular, at a certain point, I could have both effect diverging and competing simultaneously, and we'll have to see to explore the vicinity of that point, and in particular, what is then double scaling or finite n effects. So that comes, then I come to my conclusions. So I think that tensor models include naturally background independence and topology change. But they are also interesting for I think, other groups in this audience. So I didn't say it until now, but it looks like anisotropic power counting seems really very natural and very easy to implement in the tensor formalism. Why? Because you have colors. Because you have colors, they are like a bit like substitute for coordinates. And you could very well put different scalings and or in the field theory version of these models, you could put different powers of the Laplacian for different colors. So in this way, you could, I think, make contact first to the kind of philosophy of the Horava-Lifshitz models, and even perhaps later, although this is a bit different, this topology change in particular, make contact with the CDT. And we have heard in this conference that there may be some similarities between the kind of phase diagrams that occur here and there. Well, because these models include prototypes both for asymptotically free and for asymptotically safe fixed points of the Melonic type that we saw from Sylvain last talk here and of the Gross-Vulcanar type here, there seems to me also to be the kind of ideal toy world to try to understand a picture which would connect flows of the type which have been proposed during this conference. For instance, I remember the talk of Frank Sawerisik, where he showed us that the the Lorentz invariant or Euclidean invariant in the Euclidean world, models are like a slice in which you have this kind of fixed point. And we would like to also relate them to the non-invariant models and to connect the flows. And this is my last sentence. Therefore, I think that joining efforts to understand the renormalization group in this new proposal for a theory space, that may lead to a more unified picture and hopefully to unexpected discoveries.
Questions? You already have renormalizable models. What is the motivation for the anisotropic scaling? You would expect it also to improve renormalization properties?
I am very interested by anisotropic scaling for many reasons. One of the reasons, of course, is to we have the impression that the melonic world sort of is due to a certain kind of anisotropy. For instance, you see, if you look at these invariants, they are fragile along this line. And that's why the melonic world dominates. It's because essentially this is in disguise, a little bit like a vector model. You know, this thing tends to make loops which have a heavy weight linked by these fragile links. And that's exactly a bit like the vector model. But why? So the geometry is branch polymers. So we understand that branch polymers will naturally occur because of these guys. Suppose we can sort of, they are there, but what can I say? I would like to say that the interesting fact, which means that tensor models are not vector models, is that although these guys are weak, they still exist, you know? And if you change the scaling factors, like is done in Horava-Lifshitz, you can sort of you can interpolate between worlds where we have this behavior and this behavior, and we may eventually find also the phases that people from the Horava-Lifshitz or the CDT school are interested in. Namely, we don't want to have we want neither Brownian spheres, no branch polymer. We want something which lies beyond. And for the moment, one of the proposals we have, at least numerically, is to try to pick up models which have these phases. So since the initial proposal is quite far from CDT, I view, first of all, let's try to do something like Horava-Lifshitz, and then eventually we could perhaps see whether we can find in melonic world indices of this kind of phase diagram that we have also in CDT.
Okay, so some colors will remain fragile, but some others might be
enhanced.
Well, we have to find in an isotope.
We have tools to try to play with these weights. And to try to explore perhaps the space that Frank wanted to explore. Okay.
More questions?
Yes.
Do you think the intermediate field method can be tractable in models with the gauge invariants and non-Abelian groups?
Oh, the intermediate field method depends essentially on the structure of the vertex, not of the propagator. So there is no problem to apply it to your models. Sorry? You just, you know, you have even more complicated models than this. So if you have a six-point function, like in your model, then you need a sequence of two or three, in fact, intermediate fields to express it as a gluing of matrices. But essentially, if the graph is melonic, there is a well-defined prescription to break it along the fragile links into a sequence of intermediate fields. This depends on the vertex and not at all on the propagator.
More comments or questions?
So, I have to find questions.
Yeah, just maybe a more general question.
Yes.
So for example, in three dimensions, if we are to one day take this theory formulation as a new definition of 3D quantum gravity, how do we understand the relationship with the other approaches? Because, for example, if we sum over the topologies, can we ask questions that we could, for example, ask in the like in the transformers formulation, where we can.
Yes, we sum over the topology. That's what is good news. What is bad news is that the information about complicated topologies can be very deep in the power counting or 1/n expansion, so it's difficult to extract it. But it is there in principle. What is also interesting is that bad topologies, as we saw in Sylvain talks, are suppressed. So one can see it as a good thing. If one is interested into these topologies, one can see as a bad thing that they are difficult to. But so I think your question has more to do with, there is, of course, one drawback in this, starting with this purely combinatorial approach, is that it is not close to a coordinate system. What is the coordinate system? One has first to identify the random geometry that what wants to work on. It's only when one has an idea of the random geometry that one can find a good set of coordinates. For instance, for the Brownian sphere, from the random geometry point of view, it's not a very simple sphere. First of all, it has this Hausdorff dimension 4, not 2. And the geodesics are not easy to understand. So the same work for more complicated phases, as we know, will be very difficult. Yes, Jan? Wanted to comment on
this. Yeah, I'm confused about this statement because, as far as I understand it, you are performing a passing support.
Yes.
And each of these configurations there are, of course, not physical. They have not physical configurations, exactly as the passing circle of the particle. The passing particle has nothing to do with real particle.
Yeah, it depends.
I don't understand why you are interested so much in the detailed geometry of this. Because they're not physical at all.
They are the only way I can access, ultimately, to a metric and a coordinate system. Now, the metric that I can put on this depends on the choice of the propagator. If I, for instance, put a model with a, there is no additional data, and the only thing that I can imagine being the metric is the graph distance, in a certain sense, or the graph distance on the dual triangulation. But if I decorate my combinatoric nut with other variables, like is done in group field theory or in the model that presented Sylvain, then of course I have other choices to try to identify these manifolds, not only with topological manifolds, but topological manifolds with one particular metric. And then I could have, the problem is always the same, I think. It's in quantum gravity. You have a random measure on spaces with metrics, and you would like to find the typical properties of this measure. And this is what I would call physics, isn't it? Or
I don't understand.
Yes.
They represent, I mean, no physics. I mean, you can get physics out of the particle system by calculating observables, expectation values of something.
Yeah.
But the individual configurations which you pull out of the particle system has nothing, they're not physical at all. I mean, in fact, you know, if you take ordinary field theory, then they're arbitrary calculations which are not interesting.
No individual configuration is interesting, but the sum of the configuration is a random measure over spaces. That's what.
These individuals.
Yes. So the question of where do we put coordinates and identify the space with coordinates has to do with finding a kind of mean effect. For instance, if you look at the path between the only case where we understand quite in detail how one goes from the combinatoric picture to the coordinate picture is in two dimensions with the Liouville gravity. We know that we have the combinatorics. We understand that we have indeed this statistical property of the Brownian sphere. But in order to go to the Liouville measure, we have to do a path. We have to do a certain path. And we have to, for instance, find a correspondence between the planar, the measure on planar configurations and an actual configuration, like, for instance, a circle packing or a Voronoi cell or whatever. And then we could find that the combinatoric measure translates into precisely a discretized analog of the Liouville measure. And then we could go to the Liouville theory. So.
I don't understand your word.
Okay.
It is, sorry. It's my fault.
Yeah. Okay. So every single configuration is not important, but the statistical sum is.
We don't need coordinates on the individual ones, which are so different from the real world. I mean, in the Liouville field theory, we have nice coordinates. In fact, we are just using just the coordinates of the plane to describe.
Yeah, but we would like to understand why the Liouville theory is also related to the matrix model. Yes? So we would like the same understanding.
Yeah. Two more minutes. Okay. If we insist, let's start.